Yes. Can I welcome you to tonight's talk in the Mansfield series? My name is Helena Kennedy and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College. And as you know, these are occasions when we're always thrilled that friends and new friends come and join us to listen to and to participate in conversation with somebody really interesting. And I promise you that tonight our speaker is a really interesting man. Raul Martinez is a philosopher, an artist, an award-winning filmmaker. And I got to know him some years ago because I was introduced to him by a great friend of mine who has also visited this college, Alan Rickman, who's now dead, the very famous actor. And Raul had painted his portrait, and it was exhibited at the National Portrait Gallery, and I'd seen it, and at a distance seen Raul then. But then when Raul was making his documentary and was writing his book, it was suggested by Alan that he might come and interview me for it, and he did. And I've followed his work ever since. Creating Freedom, which is on sale outside, and I hope that you'll take an opportunity of getting it. It's his first book, but it's a really, really interesting book. It's informed by over a decade of research, and it's been accompanied by a documentary series of the same name. And the first episode of that, The Lottery of Birth, he wrote, he produced it and co-directed it, and it was nominated for the Best Documentary at the London Raindance Film Festival, went on to win the Activist Spirit 2012 Award at Hollywood's Artivist Festival. And he has really been recognised as somebody of a new generation who's got interesting things to say. Raul lives and works in London. His paintings are well known, and I suggest that you have a look on site on the website because they're really fine paintings. And as I say, he's exhibited in the National Portrait Gallery and in fact been part of the BP Portrait Awards where they recognise the best of those who are painting portraits. At this time. So I ask you to welcome here tonight Raul Martinez.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you, Helena, for inviting me. So a few weeks ago I decided to call this talk Free Will, Free Markets and the Future of Freedom. Now, given I only have 40 minutes to speak, this title may prove a tad ambitious, but we'll see how we go.
We might let you speak even longer.
Okay, we'll see how long everyone lasts. Now, it seems to me that the more we understand the limits of our freedom, the better placed we are to transcend them. With that in mind, I'm going to start by talking about two myths about freedom that lie at the heart of our society, which I believe cause a great deal of harm. The first of these is the myth of responsibility. And the discussion of this myth is bound up with the free will debate. And so I think it's worth straight away making the point that whether or not we have free will all depends on how we define it. If free will refers to the ability to act in accordance with the beliefs and values we hold, to employ reason and learn from our mistakes, then it's certainly something within our grasp. But if free will is a capacity to be truly responsible for our actions, then it's not something we possess. The sort of freedom that would make us truly deserving of punishment or blame, credit or reward, is an illusion, one that can't even be formulated in a coherent way. Now, much of the confusion surrounding the question of responsibility arises because of the way we think about choices. Each of us, every day, makes countless choices, and these choices reflect who we are, whether we're generous or mean, loving or petty. But the act of making a choice does little to confer responsibility. The argument to demonstrate this can be made in various ways, but its essence is so simple it can be summed up in a single line. Yes, we make choices, but we do so with a brain that we didn't choose. Okay, so let's unpack this idea. Our environment channels our vast biological potential into one particular identity. How we end up speaking, thinking, feeling, and acting owes much to the examples, opportunities, care, and ideas to which we're exposed. And so the machinery with which we make our decisions has been constructed by a process far beyond our control. This process determines the architecture of our neural circuitry, how our brains are wired. Yet the day-to-day experience of making decisions blinds us to the causal relationship that links a choice to a brain and a brain to the array of forces that shaped it. In other words, we don't create ourselves. I didn't choose to be me, and you didn't choose to be you. So across a population, capacities for empathy, mathematics, perseverance, joy, happiness, and much else vary significantly. Walk into any classroom, and you will find some children who can happily sit studying for hours, and others who find it unbearable. Some brimming with self-belief, and others wrapped with self-doubt. Different brains clearly have different capacities, and it's ultimately a matter of luck that determines which brain we have. Whether we're the star pupil or dropout, disciplined or distracted, empathetic or callous. So, to take an extreme example, a serial killer will make many horrendous choices, but they won't include choosing the brain of a serial killer. Now, at this point, you might object that yes, we are shaped by the lottery of birth, but surely as we get older, we can choose to change who we are. And this is true. And our capacity to learn and grow is of the utmost importance, but it doesn't make us truly responsible. By the time we have the critical faculties to question our identity, we're very much in possession of one. So yes, we can choose to change aspects of who we are, but the way in which we want to change, and our success in doing so, will depend on how we already are as a result of genes and experience. Now, can things really be as simple as I've said? Haven't philosophers been debating these questions for thousands of years? To both these questions, I would answer yes. I've come to believe that the lack of consensus among philosophers tells us more about the emotional reactions a topic provokes than the intractability of the problem. When we look at the arguments in favour of this myth, a clear picture emerges. Strength of belief far outweighs strength of argument. So take the philosophers John Martin Fisher and C.A. Campbell, who readily admit that when science and their belief in responsibility conflict, they're quite happy to reject science. Or take the philosopher Richard Taylor, who argues for a form of human agency that makes us morally responsible, but concedes one can hardly affirm such agency with complete comfort and wholly without embarrassment, for the conception of men and their powers which is involved is strange indeed, if not positively mysterious. Or take Roderick Chisholm, another believer in the myth, who recognises that if we are responsible, then we have a prerogative which some would attribute only to God. So such philosophers understand that for humans to possess true responsibility, miracles must be invoked. Yet they remain firmly committed to their belief. It would seem that they've arrived at their conclusion prior to any compelling reasons for accepting it. And I don't think they're exceptions. There are certainly a wide variety of arguments aimed at justifying the kind of freedom that would make us truly responsible. They just happen to be extremely unconvincing. And the fact that there are so many is itself revealing. For when we have a good argument, we're content to stick with it. The situation is well described by the philosopher Bruce Waller. He writes, "Even those philosophers who believe they have found a successful argument for moral responsibility are well aware that most of their fellow believers reject their argument as flawed, though of course those fellow believers may regard some other argument as plausible." So, while a number of philosophers continue to defend what I regard as indefensible, scientific findings have chipped away at the sacred myth of responsibility. In fact, there's a venerable tradition of leading scientists, from Darwin to Einstein to Stephen Hawking, who reject the myth. And today, a growing list of psychologists, neuroscientists, biologists, and physicists are doing the same. And this makes sense when we consider the core assumptions of science. For a long time, it was assumed that we lived in a deterministic universe, in which there is only one possible future, and every event is a necessary consequence of prior events. This vision of the universe held up very well for most observations, but appeared to break down at the quantum level, where the universe seems to be indeterministic, or, as some theorists have put it, Instead of determined outcomes, we find determined probabilities. But the point is that neither of these possibilities provide the conditions for the kind of freedom that would make us truly responsible. If the world is deterministic, then what we do is ultimately the product of events that took place long before we existed. If it's indeterministic, then some events are random events. But clearly, if my arm moves because a random event has occurred in my brain, it's not something I can take responsibility for. To date, I'm not aware of a single scientific finding that offers any support to the idea that we are truly responsible creatures. On the other hand, there's a growing body of evidence against its existence. Experiment after experiment demonstrates how the majority of our decision-making takes place unconsciously. As a neuroscientist David Eagleman put it, your consciousness is like a tiny stowaway on a transatlantic steamship, taking credit for the journey without acknowledging the massive engineering underfoot. So study after study confirms that our capacities have a neurological basis. So for instance, Simon Baron Cohen, a leading researcher in empathetic development, suggests that when it comes to varying degrees of empathy, perhaps we should see such behaviour not as a product of individual choice or responsibility, but as a product of the person's neurology. He goes on to say, we do not hold someone with schizophrenia responsible for having an hallucination, just as we don't hold someone with diabetes responsible for their increased thirst. In the case of the person with diabetes, we blame low levels of insulin. That is, we recognise the biomedical cause of the behaviour. Equally, if someone's behaviour is a result of their low empathy, which itself stems from the underactivity of the brain's empathy circuit, and which ultimately is a result of their genetic makeup and or their early experience, in what sense is the person responsible? And there's another source of evidence that we can look at, which comes from long-term studies, such as the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. This found clear correlations between early childhood trauma and emotional and cognitive impairment. Impairment which increases the likelihood of violence, disease, disability, and premature death. For instance, each traumatic event in a child's life appears to make them 2 to 4 times more likely to develop an addiction. Another long-term study tracked 14,000 children and found that by age 5, those with degree-level educated parents were, on average, 1.5 years ahead of their less privileged counterparts in terms of their linguistic ability, and 13 months ahead on problem solving. Now, it's not just that we don't choose our own brains. We also don't choose the context in which we make our choices, and this can make all the difference. So dozens of social psychology experiments have shown how small changes in our environment, the aroma of freshly baked bread, a rise in volume in background noise, being exposed to an image of a dollar bill, all of these things can have significant impacts on our moral behaviour. And the impact of these changes almost always occurs unconsciously. From atoms to stars to galaxies, there's been a clear paradigm shift over the last century, away from viewing the world in terms of static things and towards a view in which everything is process and flux. When we study something closely, instead of an object, we find a set of dynamic relationships. Now, I think it's time to place ourselves in this world of ceaseless change and connection. We are not discrete, separate entities. We are the walking embodiment of all the relationships in our lives, relationships with nature, culture, and our built and social environment. The world continually changes us as we continually change it. And what are the consequences of this paradigm shift? Some philosophers, such as Saul Smilansky, accept the argument, but believe it's too dangerous a conclusion to release to the public. He goes so far as to advocate a conspiracy of silence for the greater good. I believe such fears are misplaced. It's the myth itself that's dangerous. The notion that we are somehow truly responsible for the way we are and what we do has led to cruel policies and absurd beliefs. There are many reasons this myth has endured for so long, but prime among them is that it's highly convenient for those with wealth and power. It appears to legitimise the claim that the rich deserve their wealth while the poor deserve their poverty. It fuels a culture of blame and entitlement, which offers a tacit yet powerful endorsement of inequality and oppression. This has been demonstrated in studies which show that the stronger our belief in responsibility, the more we blame victims, advocate harsher punishments, and view the world as fair and just. To reject the myth is to acknowledge the decisive role of luck in all of our lives. Ultimately, luck is what separates the rich from the poor, the saint from the sinner, the prisoner from the judge, and the powerful from the powerless. So notions of credit, blame, punishment, and reward largely lose their meaning. In other words, no one is more deserving of suffering or happiness than anyone else, whoever they are, whatever they may have done. Now, it's true that the impact of a new idea will always depend on the web of beliefs into which it's introduced. No fact comes with its own interpretation. But on the whole, I think exposing this myth is likely to be a crucial step towards a more just, equal, and compassionate world, in which the impulse to blame is overcome by the desire to understand, and feelings of entitlement give way to humility. As Darwin put it, the view should teach one profound humility. One deserves no credit or blame for anything, and nor ought one to blame others. And as Einstein once wrote, seeing through the myth has been an inspiration to me since my youth up, and a continual consolation and unfailing wellspring of patience in the face of the hardships of life, my own and others. Now, rejecting the myth has profound implications for the way we think about many things: punishment, reward, justice, control, identity, democracy, and much else. There is clearly so much more to say on this topic, that's why I wrote a 500-page book, but for now I'll just express a hope that the moral and political force of these arguments, rather than being seen as something to be feared and resisted, are instead recognised as tools for building a better world. Okay, so let's move on to our second myth, the myth of free markets. John Maynard Keynes once declared, "Capitalism is the astounding belief that the most wickedest of men will do the most wickedest of things for the greatest good of everyone." Astounding as the belief may be, Keynes himself subscribed to it. Speculating about the future economic prospects of society, he concluded that capitalism would ultimately make everyone rich. But, he cautioned, in order to reach that point, we must pretend to ourselves and to everyone that fair is foul and foul is fair, for foul is useful and fair is not. Avarice and usury and precaution must be our gods for a little longer still, for only they can lead us out of the tunnel of economic necessity into daylight. The religious terminology used by Keynes is revealing. The doctrines of the market, as many have observed, are not so different from religious doctrine. Instead of faith being placed in a powerful unseen God, it is placed in a powerful unseen invisible hand. Just as God has all our best interests at heart, so the invisible hand can be trusted to produce the best outcomes for all. Like religion, the market comes with its own morality. But it's not compassion, forgiveness, and love. It's greed, selfishness, and avarice. As Friedrich Hayek put it, we will benefit our fellow men most if we are guided solely by the striving for gain. So according to this modern faith, which starts not with the first man, Adam, but the first economist, Adam Smith, the road to heaven is paved with bad intentions, in the words of E.F. Schumacher. Now, the relationship between economics and freedom is an interesting one. The economist Milton Friedman, one of the most influential of the 20th century, claimed that even if capitalism was less efficient than some other system, he would still favour it due to its unique capacity to deliver the freedom to choose. This is the second great myth, then, that free markets produce freedom. It animates the most influential ideology of the last 40 years, neoliberalism. In his writings, Friedman presents the market, as many still see it today, as a bastion of freedom, an institution characterized by voluntary, mutually beneficial transactions. It's highly misleading to frame things this way. Imagine you're walking down the street and someone points a gun at your head, threatening to kill you unless you hand over all your money. Well, if you agree, that's a mutually beneficial transaction. You get to keep your life and they get to keep your money. Of course, it's not a voluntary transaction. You are compelled by circumstance to accept it. But the reality is that in the market, every single day, people are compelled by circumstance to accept all kinds of things, to do difficult, dangerous, demeaning, poorly paid work. People are compelled by need, the need to feed their children, to heat their homes, to pay their rent, to care for sick relatives. The obvious point is that poverty is itself coercive. Freedom in the market expands and contracts with spending power. Now, as uncontroversial as that may sound, it's long been denied by advocates of the free market system. Typically, they make the claim that a homeless person is as free as anyone else to buy a yacht. They just happen to lack the capability to do so. The idea is that the poor have the same formal freedoms as the rich, they just lack the resources to exercise them. Really, it's just wordplay. How can a person be free to do what they are not allowed or able to do? Imagine a prison in which inmates can walk free if they pay £100,000. These free market advocates would have us believe that the poorer prisoners, left behind in their cells, have as much freedom as their wealthier counterparts sitting at home with their families. It's quite ludicrous. So how do the right wing get away with claiming that they are in favour of freedom or showing such little concern about poverty? One way is by defining freedom very narrowly in terms of negative freedom, the absence of interference. And then claiming that their preferred society is one with a small non-interventionist state which prioritises individual liberty. They contrast this with the socialist vision of society, which requires a large interventionist state, one that will constantly meddle in our lives and curtail our liberties in the pursuit of equality. This is how we arrive at the conclusion that freedom and equality are conflicting ideals. It's a simple story, but highly misleading. Even if we stick to the inadequate, narrow definition of negative liberty, the argument doesn't hold up. This is because it ignores the obvious point that the less money I have, the more I will be subject to state interference. If I attempt to eat food, board a train, cross private land, reside in my flat, or obtain medicine, without being able to pay for the privilege, the state will be there, waiting in the wings to stop me. As the philosopher G.O. Cohen showed, money is a kind of permission slip, which enables us to access goods and services which otherwise would be denied to us by state power. The less money we have, the less freedom we have. The private property system only seems non-coercive if you have plenty of money. From the perspective of those at the bottom of society, the right-wing state is anything but small. It blocks, constrains, and punishes at every turn. Now, there's another way in which markets are non-voluntary. Those who enter into a mutually beneficial transaction are not the only ones affected by it. Economic transactions generate costs which are not borne by those directly involved. So, for instance, a new car will create more traffic and more pollution, two things that are going to impact the lives of others detrimentally. These impacts are known as negative externalities. And it's in the financial interests of corporations to externalize as many costs as possible. But really, this is a kind of theft in which you take something for nothing and leave others to pick up the bill. And this bill can be quite substantial. In 2015, a remarkable study was published by the IMF. It found that the externalized costs of the fossil fuel industry amounted to $10 million a minute. So in the time I've been speaking, the world's governments have been dumped with a bill of roughly $200 million. Another study looked at the externalities of the fast food industry. It estimated that if you included all the externalized costs of a hamburger, it would be selling for about $200 a piece. So the pervasiveness of externalities destroys the idea of efficient, self-correcting markets, characterized by voluntarism and freedom of choice. Markets can be extremely coercive institutions, enabling the few to profit from the labour and sacrifice of the many. I'll briefly touch on one more way in which markets erode freedom. The concentrations of wealth they produce are incompatible with a functioning democracy. As power is transferred from a democratic state to the market, society moves away from the principle of one person, one vote, to to £1 one vote. In the market, those with more money have more votes. They possess far greater power to shape the future. And concentrations of power, whether economic or political, are always a threat to freedom. I mean, when you think about it, marking a ballot takes a second, and once it's done, a typical voter's democratic participation is over until the next election. But corporate participation is continuous. Between elections, the work of lobbyists, think tanks, and lawyers never ends, and the revolving door between industry and government never stops spinning. And corporate power has a near monopoly on our channels of communication. Most of our media is controlled by a handful of billionaires and dependent on corporate advertising for its survival. Left to its own devices, the market system exerts a predictable and corrupting force on media content. I mean, just to see how important ownership is, just imagine that tomorrow all of our media was taken over by card-carrying communists. We're going to end up some very different news headlines. So, when people speak of the free market, it's worth asking, free from what? And I think too often, it's free from democratic control. Once again, there's so much more to say about these issues, but the key point is this. Deciding where to draw the boundaries of the market and how to structure the rules which govern it are not technical questions, they're moral questions. The positions we take will reflect our values, concerns, and priorities. If we believe a poor child has the same right to proper medical treatment, parental love, and education as a rich child, we are rejecting market logic. If we believe people should have access to clean air, clean water, and healthy food, whatever their bank balance may be, we are rejecting market logic. If we believe genes, people, qualifications, elections, and court decisions should not be bought and sold, we are rejecting market logic. Okay, so we've looked at two influential myths about freedom. I want to say a few things about the future of freedom, but first I just want to recap why I think these myths are so politically significant. The myth of responsibility is highly convenient for the establishment. It enables blame to be heaped on the individual, while shifting attention away from the institutional factors at the heart of the problems that we face. It also weakens the moral case for redistributing wealth by adding credibility to the claim that people deserve their fate, be it a life of privilege or hardship. The myth that free markets promote freedom enables power in society to be distributed according to the principle of £1, one vote, instead of one person, one vote. It also conveniently adopts a conception of freedom that is blind to the differences between the liberty of a homeless person and a billionaire. Now, I think these myths are part of a broader trend in which the language of freedom has been a pleasant mask placed on a destructive, unjust, and unsustainable system. We've been sold an impoverished vision of this ideal, one that elevates property rights over human rights, one more concerned with free markets than free people. Behind this mask is a world in which 1% of humanity now controls as much wealth as the other 99% combined. A world in which the ecological conditions for our survival are rapidly being destroyed. In Britain, behind this mask, we find 16 million people with savings of less than £100, and the richest 10% earning more wealth than the other 90% combined. Compounding the problem, leading experts estimate that over £100 billion a year is lost to tax avoidance, with some of the largest corporations paying little or no tax at all. And against this background, we have a government planning on lowering corporation tax. We also find that an economic crisis created by the financial industry has led to a politics of austerity that continues to punish the most vulnerable. In just 1 year, 10,000 people died shortly after being declared fit for work or able to prepare for work. The impact on disabled people has been so extreme that a UN inquiry recently concluded that systematic violations of the rights of people with disabilities have taken place. We find that rather than rescuing the economy, policies of austerity have cost Britain over £100 billion. We also find a leader, Theresa May, rightly dubbed the Prime Minister, PRY, whose government recently passed into law, as Edward Snowden put it, the most extreme system of surveillance in the history of Western democracy. It goes further than many autocracies. We find that Britain is the world's second largest supplier of arms, with 7.9 billion worth of arms being sold to countries on our own human rights blacklist. So these are regimes judged by the Foreign Office to have the worst or greatest number of human rights violations. We discover that since 1945, the British state has been complicit in the deaths of over 10 million people around the world. And that's a conservative estimate. And we find that hurtling towards environmental devastation, the UK government continues to hold the accelerator to the floor, channelling £6 billion a year in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry in the UK, and a further £3 billion abroad. At the same time, it cuts subsidies to solar and wind energy. Now, this is while climate scientists warn that business as usual will create a planet able to support less than a billion people by the end of the century. So in other words, business as usual involves wiping out most of humanity within 80 years. I mean, for me, what I see behind this mask of liberalism is a political and corporate elite more ready to accept the destruction of the ecosystem, and with it billions of human beings, than to challenge capitalism. Now, the lesson to be learned is this. The centre ground of political opinion, where many feel most comfortable, is not where extremes are avoided, it's where they are normalised. The location of the centre ground has no objective basis. It's a social construct, a product of power relations. In today's world, there is nothing moderate, reasonable, or balanced about occupying this political terrain. To do so is largely to favour business as usual, the ongoing destruction of our ecosystem, the continual erosion of democracy, the acceleration of inequality, the waging of wars, the support of abusive regimes, and the dehumanisation of those whose suffering is politically inconvenient, whether they be drowning in the Mediterranean or queuing up at food banks. The future of freedom depends on a radical, progressive politics. Frankly, if we're not radical, I don't think we're paying attention. But when I use the word radical, I think it's worth clarifying what's meant. Etymologically, the meaning of the word is bound up with the idea of getting to the root of something, of getting to the core or origin of a problem. So that's what radical politics tries to do. But there's really no way to get to the core of the problems that we face without tackling the logic of capitalism and the concentration of wealth that it's created. We're all familiar with the dystopian narratives in which our technological creations overpower us. But the real threat lies not in robots or artificial intelligence, but the economic system we have produced and the corporate entities we have created. In the process of creating and exploiting profitable opportunities, which the system of capitalism demands, the power of concentrated wealth reorganises society to reduce and eliminate obstacles it encounters. Unfortunately for us, these obstacles include the effectiveness of democratic structures, the integrity of Earth's life support systems, the rights of workers, and the health and happiness of citizens. All are sacrificed at the altar of short-term profit. To defend these things requires transforming the way our society works. Now today, the politics of hate is thriving on the failure of establishment politics to respond to the crises it has created. This toxic politics of division, patriarchy, and racism has gained increasing support in recent years. The likes of Trump represent a new category of threat. But I think it's also important to recognise that if there's anything positive to be taken from Trump's victory, it's that our system, irrational and exploitative as it is, now has a more honest face. Obama, as the first person of colour to occupy the White House, perfectly embodied, with his eloquence and charm, the pleasant mask of liberalism. And with this cover came some tangible benefits, but in the end a mask is worn to conceal and to deceive. His record on immigrants, wealth, inequality, the environment, foreign policy and human rights demonstrates remarkable continuity with his predecessors. But with Trump in power, someone who embodies the irrationality and prejudice that has always been at the heart of global capitalism, the mask of liberalism has slipped, and we have an opportunity to build a bold movement to confront the ugly realities that have always existed behind it. Now, in building this movement, I see two related battles. The first is a struggle against dehumanisation. Demonising certain groups is a standard way to deflect attention from the failures and injustices of a system in crisis. Just in the last year, we've seen people of colour, Muslims, Jews, women, LGBT communities, refugees, disabled people, and immigrants all targeted as scapegoats. The first battle, then, is to defend and promote empathy, compassion, and unity. To transcend the boundaries, physical and conceptual, that separate humanity into the worthy and unworthy. Rejecting the myth of responsibility is an important step in this direction. The second battle is to transform the defining institutions of society itself, to expand and deepen democracy across society, in our schools, in the economy, in the media, and at every level of government. Crucial to this is redefining the aims of society away from endless profits and growth and towards a sustainable system geared to human flourishing, in which the world's ample resources are shared far more equally. Rejecting the myth of free markets is an important step in this direction. The future of freedom, then, depends on building a movement that is united by a vision of equality and solidarity, one that elevates democracy over capitalism, planet over profit, and human rights over property rights. Rationalizations for inaction are pervasive, from denial of problems to cynicism about solutions, and they need to be overcome. For me, the most meaningful freedom is found in being able to use our choices to serve our deepest values. Which is why, though we can't know what the outcome will be, I take heart from the beautiful words of the historian Howard Zinn, who writes, "If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now, as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvellous victory." Thank you.